Paris Matthews, and this is the Tell Me the Truth About Life podcast, poems that matter and why. It's launched for National Poetry Day's 25th anniversary. I love to champion poetry because when someone shares a poem with you, it gives you an insight both into the person who shared it with you and the world we live in. In this podcast series, author Michael Mopurgo, Instagram poet Nikita Gill, actor Jay DeNuca, teacher Kate Clancy, and comedian Henry Normal each take us on a tour of their Touchstone poems, in conversation here with Susanna Herbert of the Forward Arts Foundation. I hope you enjoy it.
Hello, this year National Poetry Day turns 25, and we're celebrating by inviting people to share poems that speak truth to them. I'm Susanna Herbert, and I run Forward Arts Foundation, which is the charity responsible for National Poetry Day. And together with Michael O'Mara, we're publishing a selection of the choices of poetry that people have sent in to us in a new anthology called Tell Me the Truth About Life. Now, thousands of people responded to our call out, including my guest today, Nikita Gill, who is herself a poet whose work reaches 500,000 people all over the world through Instagram. Now, whether it's writ large on banners in women's marches or passed from phone to phone via fans as disparate as the political cartoonist Chris Riddell or Khloe Kardashian, Nikita's words reach people. They connect. So I'm talking today to Nikita about the poetry encounters that have shaped her, from the Indian songs and stories of her childhood to the electric shocks of Emily Dickinson, right through to the present day, when her own poems have become lifelines to hundreds of thousands of people worldwide. Nikita.
Hello.
Nikita, you were born exactly 32 years ago in Belfast, and you are a British Indian poet. Can you tell me, when did you realise what poetry can do?
I was so little. I think my mum, when I was very small, she used to tell me these stories, but we didn't call them stories, we called them baths. And the word bath literally means to talk. But it was more than talking, it was really lyrical. There were stories from folklore, from where we were from, and there were stories from, you know, that she would just make up to make us go to sleep and things like that. And it really impacted me profoundly. And it wasn't just the stories and how lyrical they were. It was how they were told and where they were told. In the middle of Delhi monsoons, with a cup of tea, you know, and mum telling these stories. It just created this environment of poetry, really. So when I first came across poetry as an actual form, it was, I was in the fourth or the fifth grade, and we read On a Snowy Evening by Robert Frost. And that was the first time that I encountered poetry, which was, it was short, it was a short poem, but there was so much packed into it. And there's so many interpretations of it. And that was when I learned what poetry was. It meant different things to different people. And I think my entire classroom interpreted that poem completely differently. Some people just took it for like face value. And other people were like, oh, but this is about something more meaningful. It's about life and like how much we have to do. And it's about patience and it's about death. And it's about, and it was really interesting that a bunch of 10-year-olds were like looking into the work of Robert Frost and like coming up with such different perspectives. So that was the first time that I really understood. But what was funny about it was that Robert Frost is an American poet. And he managed to connect with a bunch of kids in India, like miles and miles away in a completely different era, in such a profound way. I found that fascinating.
Tell me about the effect that you felt when you encountered other poets. I mean, I'm particularly curious to see that the poems you nominated for this anthology include several works by Emily Dickinson, who, again, superficially you might say, what does a woman who was basically enclosed in her bedroom, very seldom went out, never published really in her lifetime at all, What could a woman like that have in common with you, who you're modern, you live in the world, you take buses, you go places? How does someone like that speak to you?
The most wonderful thing about Emily Dickinson that I absolutely fell in love with was how much she was able to pack in such few words. There's so much electricity in her words that you would never think that she was just sitting in her bedroom and writing all of this. There's something so magical about the fact that there was so much inside her that she was able to pack so much into her work. So the poem which I've chosen is Tell All the Truth, But Tell It Slant by Emily Dickinson. Tell all the truth, but tell it slant. Success in circuit lies, too bright for our infirm delight. The truth's superb surprise, as lightning to the children eased with explanation kind. The truth must dazzle gradually, or every man be blind. How powerful is that? The idea that the truth itself can blind people, and falsehoods can blind people too. I think what's interesting about Emily Dickinson's work is that while sometimes poetry can be insular, her work manages to carve the insula from what is relatable. And everyone looks at her work and kind of goes, oh, this is what she's trying to say. And in my head, I always picture Emily Dickinson probably sitting somewhere listening to people coming up with different interpretations of her work and laughing, going, yeah, sure, that's what I meant to say.
I'm very interested in how you approach Emily Dickinson, because it strikes me that you have spotted what is open in her. This is not a kind of closed form poetry. Mm-hmm. And I would love to know whether you have found the responses that you get to your poetry on Instagram also displays the same kind of openness to different interpretations. So you talk about Emily Dickinson wondering how everybody makes different things of her words. Do you, when you are looking at the responses to your poems on Instagram, do you marvel at the variety of things which people say?
Absolutely. I think the reason why Instagram is actually popular is, one, because it's made poetry accessible to so many people, where it probably would have been a place where, you know, people would have to go to a bookshop, go to the poetry section, or go to the library, find a poetry book, and then read poetry. Now, instead, you find it, like, in your Facebook feed, or you find it in your Instagram feed or on Twitter. And I think that accessibility has helped people interact with poetry. It's something poets have always known, you know, that if people are able to actually read the work and approach the work, they will find different things in it. They will find hope in it. They will find, you know, they will no longer be lonely if they read the work. And I think that's what's so remarkable about finding poetry on Instagram or Facebook. And when people respond to my work, it is literally as soon as they've read the poem and processed the poem. And I think that digestion, that creates this kind of very electric energy through the responses, where people have interpreted something which I thought, okay, this is why I'm writing this and this is how it is in my head. And they've come up with a completely different interpretation of it that I didn't even see, and a completely different reference, which I was like, oh, I didn't know I put that in there.
Can you give me an example, perhaps? One of the things that I'm really curious about is the way in which people have responded. Young women have felt they can think and talk about truths which might have seemed too private to share. They can think and talk about those because you have shown them how.
Well, this is actually, there is a particular poem which I think brought some of the most interesting, profound, and kind of almost secret feelings to the surface for a lot of people. It's a poem called An Indescribable Unbelonging, which I put up on my Instagram feed, and it goes like this. An indescribable unbelonging. When I leave for somewhere not home, My mother reminds me of the ways I should not forget my ancestors. Earth people like me. Earth people like her. She feeds me curd sweetened for luck, giving me only easy names in her prayers because God, like her, couldn't handle the hard edges that become her child. There's a gravity in her fingers, a pull of childhood, familiarity I have loved and hated to leave. She asks me why I choose to live away. I try to explain falling to the ground. In the exoskeleton of a home I have made for myself, I look up words for unbelonging. I look up the words for nowhere person. I Google how to live with the people you love without hurting them. Neither dictionary nor Google knows what to say to me anymore.
That is a very powerful piece of writing.
Thank you.
What it does for me is it points elsewhere. It points to words which we don't yet have. And I'd love to know, what was the response?
So I think, like, this idea of unbelonging is something a lot of young women, especially young women of color in this country and immigrants, they kind of feel a lot because, you know, there's this idea of two homes, but then there's also the idea of home is home is home, you know, and you kind of reach a point where you feel like you don't belong anywhere, but at the same time, you can't give up either home. And it's this pull, and it's this constant feeling of, is my home with my mother and my childhood, or is my home here in this new life I'm building for myself? And you realize every time you leave, and it gets harder every year. And that's how I feel. It gets harder for me to leave every year. And that is what people responded to. That is what young women especially responded to, going, in a lot of ethnic cultures, it's quite hard, especially for you to let your girls go out and earn and do these jobs, which, you know, you probably didn't have in the last generation or the generation before that. And now suddenly you've got, like, girls who are, like, you know, lawyers or doctors or coming abroad to study and, like, becoming writers and doing amazing things with their lives and, like, culturally taking women forward, like, hundreds of years. But it comes at a cost, and it comes at a personal cost. And this is the personal cost. And I feel like there was always this guilt in me, which was about, you know, leaving home and then coming here and working. And I feel like a lot of people experience that, but we're almost not allowed to talk about it because these are your choices. You made these choices for yourself. And these were the responses that I was getting. It's like, oh my God, I feel like someone's actually voiced something which was so deep inside me, but I've always felt scared to respond to because I've always felt like, well, you made these choices for yourself. Now live with them, you know? And it's fine. It's you don't have to regret the choices that you make to be able to feel the missing and the pull. That's human, you know?
In terms of truth, that connects very strongly, I think, with the National Poetry Day theme and with what Emily Dickinson said in that poem that you recited so beautifully for us, the idea that it's not just one thing. It's not just a fact, a statement. It's not simple. And sometimes it is a dynamic, it's a process. Mm. And I think in the way in which you talk about the poem creating a bridge between you and the readers and their feelings, and you and your feelings, and you perhaps and your past, illustrates something which I'm inching towards with National Poetry Day, which is the idea of a poem as a space for imaginative sympathy between people.
Yes.
Who are divided by space and time.
Yeah.
And that today seems to be quite necessary, which takes me on to, I guess, politics, because your poetry has been used in a political context. It's been used in women's marches. Yeah. And I wondered whether you know, how you responded when you saw your words used like that, and if you can tell us which words they were.
I think the first time I saw my words being used in that context was the first Women's March, and it was the words, "I hope our daughters get to be little girls for as long as they need to be." And it's part of a greater poem which I wrote, which someone obviously, because I'd only shared that excerpt, they saw it and they kind of put it on a placard. And that has found its way into many women's marches, that one line. And I think the reason why it hit people, and that's the line people chose, is because we force our little girls to grow up quite quickly. We warn them of the dangers, which we have to warn them of. But in the process, we make a bargain of their innocence. You know, we tell them, you can't do this, 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 and this. Well, my brother can do it. Yes, but he's a boy. And you are more vulnerable because you are a girl. So you have to grow up a bit faster. You have to do things a bit faster. You have to be more mature. And the whole poem is about this idea of, but you are a girl, therefore it is expected of you to be more mature than your brother, than someone else. And I think it's something which I got told a lot when I was young. And it was told as a joke that, you know, oh yeah, girls mature faster than boys. We don't. We're forced to. And we don't have choices in that. And which is why I wrote the poem about hoping for a world where little girls can be little girls for as long as they need until they're ready to mature.
I think it's time for that other Emily Dickinson poem then, because there is something which perhaps hasn't changed that much since 19th century America. It is expectations.
Exactly.
So why don't you try it for us?
They shut me up in prose. They shut me up in prose, as when a little girl, they put me in the closet because they liked me still. Still, could themselves have peeped and seen my brain go round. They might, as wise, have lodged a bird for treason in the pound. Himself has but to will, and easy as a star, look down upon captivity and laugh. No more have I.
I love the laughter at the end. It's impossible to trap a free spirit.
Exactly.
And yet when I say that, it doesn't really add up to much. It's the way in which she indicates, possibly in the gaps between the words and the music of it, that there is something that people can't quite pin down.
Yeah.
And I wondered, this may be something you could talk about in terms of culture. In a patriarchal society, if a young woman says something, she might be told, that's not your place to say something.
Exactly.
But if she says to her father or her senior relatives, oh, but I'm writing poetry, can she do more? And I'm thinking about the way in which Instagram seems to be a space, particularly for young women of colour.
I think what's really interesting about that is that the first time I actually experienced poetry by women, like it made me feel seen, was Maya Angelou and Audre Lorde. And they wrote poetry which was so fearless, and it was so much about who they were as people, women, queer, of color. And it moved me. And I think that's what Instagram is doing. It's giving voices to people who, you know, have a very different take than what people are used to. And that is what's bringing this community of young poets or older poets who may not have had a space to be able to share their work, who may have been gatekept out because poetry had to be a certain way. And now with Instagram, poetry can be what people can associate with. And it's something which, you know, makes you feel seen in an experience, and it makes you feel something in a very short amount or little amount of words, you know.
So why does poetry seem to matter so much now? We've had a lot of reporting recently about the boom in poetry sales and the demographic. It's young. It's it's mainly young. Most buyers of poetry books are under the age of 34. So Obviously, social media has something to do with it, but I think there's more as well. You know, why now is poetry proving such an appealing form to speak in and to listen in?
Because we're living in very interesting times. We are living in times where, which have never been more progressive and regressive at the same time. There's never been such a clash in the last like 20, 30 years as there has been today. And because of social media, those inequalities and the things which may have been hidden from us are no longer hidden from us because information has become so easy to access. And it's, I think that's why poetry has become so important, because I believe all poems are political. All writing is political. And to be able to associate with that writing, it needs to be the truth, someone's truth. It doesn't have to be every single person's truth, because there's so many different versions of the truth. But it has to be a truth that someone can associate with. And poets are truth tellers. Poets are activists. Poets are teachers. And that is why people are turning to their poets. I believe there's a very famous saying, and I can't remember for the life of me where it comes from. If society collapses, it will be because people listen to their politicians and not to their poets. Because poets are so truthful about how they feel and their vulnerabilities. And they give the voiceless a voice.
Tell me, when you see your words divorced from your name and spread across the internet, and I'm talking now about Khloe Kardashian, who took one of your poems, and I don't know if she actually passed it off as one of her own or she just shared it in a kind of slightly careless tribute.
Yeah.
But what, can you talk to me about that? Because you talk about the politics of poetry, and I think you mean small p, but certainly when something is taken from you, It's a little bit political too.
Yeah, I think what's interesting about poetry right now is that, or just in art in general, is the idea of like how easy it is to take a piece of art, not attribute it, and just send it across the world, and it just goes viral, and no one knows who created it, and it's almost stifling because it's taking a poet's or a writer's voice or an artist's voice, and like the person who actually did the creation is just left behind somewhere in the dust. Now, there are two ways to look at it. Like, I think when it first happened to me, I was really upset. I felt like someone who's very powerful, and at the time I was quite new to this, had taken something which was quite personal to me, and it was like covered in tabloids and everything, and it was coming across like she had like written it herself, and it felt like a violation in a way. But as time has gone on, I've seen a lot of other great writers talk about this, and I've kind of learned a lot from this. And Margaret Atwood says, once a piece of work has been written, once one of her pieces of work has been written and is out in the world, it doesn't belong to you anymore. It belongs to the world. And that kind of really helped me, instead of going out and picking fights with every single person who doesn't attribute me, to kind of go, well, it's doing its job, you know. It's out in the world and it's doing its job.
Now, you're very committed to poetry, and you have a book of your own poetry coming out this year. It's called Great Goddesses, and it's published by Ebury, and it's out in September. But can you tell us a little bit about why you have written, why you've decided to tell the truth again in poetry in a form that refers again to things of the past?
I think there's something really necessary in women retelling the narratives of women and making them the multidimensional characters that they are, the multifaceted characters that they are. And mythological women have had the short end of the stick for a very long time. And I think it's because, for instance, with Greek mythology, the stories have been told by male poets predominantly. And when that happens, they're able to make the male characters very multidimensional. The male gods get personalities which are, you know, which are gray and black and white and all of the shades in between. And the women are just, oh, she was petty and pretty, or she was, you know, angry and petty, or she was, and it's sad because there are these very powerful goddesses like Athena, the goddess of wisdom, or, you know, Aphrodite, the goddess of love, and they're kind of dismissed by these narratives, which I felt were unfair, which is why I went and wrote Great Goddesses, which covers the gamut of the goddesses and kind of gives them their stories back and lets them do things wrong or learn and be bad or have the hubris, but also have lots of redeeming qualities, which could have been missed in the initial narratives that were put forth about them.
So it's a counter story.
Yeah.
one of many counter truths that poetry can do. Now, you are a champion of Forward Arts Foundation's year-round campaign to celebrate poetry's value to society, particularly the power to connect us and to remind individuals that we're not alone. We have our own voices, but we are part of a bigger group. We are social animals as well. Now, National Poetry Day falls in early October, and I wanted to ask you as our final thing, what would you say to listeners who don't know where to go, what to do, how to participate in National Poetry Day? What three things can they do, not necessarily on the day itself, on any day, which will give them confidence that poetry is a space that's for them as well?
I think the biggest thing that you can do is go on YouTube and search up spoken word poetry and just listen. Just listen to the voices of these people who are so different from each other. And eventually you will find something which moves you so much, it actually changes your life. It will soothe you to listen to poets anyway, but you will find that one poem which will move you to the point that you're just like, I'm completely not alone in this world. And this has given me so much hope. And you will keep it with you. You will keep it with you for a long time. The second thing which I recommend is going on Instagram and just seeing these short digestible poems that, you know, in just a sentence maybe, or just like a single verse, are able to communicate such great depth and feeling that you can actually respond to and talk to the poets. And most poets on Instagram are quite responsive, you know, and you can end up having a conversation with a complete stranger who completely feels like you do. And again, that combats that loneliness. And if you're somebody who doesn't want to have the conversation but just wants the introspection, there's so many great poetry websites out there. And National Poetry Day does such a great job of like listing them as well. But my two favorite websites are definitely Poetry Foundation and poets.org. And there's always something on there for me to read, which leaves me with a feeling of, wow, I didn't think of it like that, or I feel heard.
And I wanted to say, you know, a special thank you to you for being part of this podcast and also being part of a new book published for National Poetry Day's 25th anniversary. This anthology is called Tell Me the Truth About Life. It's published by Michael O'Mara Books with an introduction by Keris Matthews. It's out on the 12th of September. And it's an absolute must-read because it shows you what happens when you ask people to nominate poems that mean something to them. You don't just get poems, you get the reasons why they love them, and you get the connections that are forged by a poem between people who are separated by time and by space. So thank you again to Nikita for illustrating this so beautifully with her choices and talking so generously about the work of other poets.
Thank you for having me.
Tell Me the Truth About Life is published to coincide with the 25th anniversary of National Poetry Day on October the 3rd, 2019. It's published in association with National Poetry Day and Michael O'Mara.
If you've enjoyed this podcast, please tell your friends and share it. Or better still, find a poem that speaks truth to you and let me, Keris Matthews, know what it is on Twitter using hashtag TellMeTheTruthAboutLife.